days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you, Sarita, and thank you, Frank. This is John Barber. Welcome once again. Had a number of people contact me in the last couple of days when they knew you were going to be on. And a couple of them bought your book from your previous appearance. They heard you on another show, loved your book. And then somebody sent me this great quote from John Ehrlichman's book. And are you familiar with the quote?
Sure. Yeah, okay. I heard about that.
If you don't mind, what I'd like to do, acknowledge the fact that the viewer sent it in and use it as sort of a springboard to introduce you to.
Sure.
And your book is wonderful. Wonderful.
Thanks
by the
so
way.
Much, John.
And I'm stunned by a couple of things that I uncovered, which I will relate to you when I get there. And I'm going to try to talk you out of not writing your next book as a novel.
Okay.
Okay.
That's funny. Yeah, I have at least, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 pages of endnotes in the novel, but I'm debating whether I should take the endnotes out, you know. It's
Thank you, Sarita, and thank you, Frank. This is John Barber. Welcome once again to John Barber's World, April the 18th, 5 p.m. here in Las Vegas, Disneyland for the depraved. Remember the television show The Untouchables? Las Vegas is now home to two shows called The Unwatchables, Cat House and Gigolos, otherwise known as Democrats and Republicans. Wow, are they unwatchable. Over the weekend, George Clooney threw a fundraiser for Hillary, raising over $2 million. The first million was raised with a $35,000 admission fee. The balance was raised with an additional $35,000 fee if after her speech anyone threw up. George, to me, is now George Looney. On the other hand, Bernie Sanders had a $27 a plate dinner, and all around the country with thousands more donors raised even more than Hillary. It is so strange, folks. Hillary raises barely as much as Bernie, nearly as much as Bernie, with just a handful of donors. And also, as Wisconsin just showed us, somehow, even though outvoted by thousands, she gains more delegates with just a handful of votes. So I'll remind you of what Mark Twain said 100 years ago. Quote, "If voting made a difference, they wouldn't let us do it." Folks, honestly, I do not like to swear, as I've often told you, except on a golf course where it's the best part of my game. However, this freak show, useless election, compels me to describe my observations as such. As a kid, watching Frank Capra, Jimmy Stewart movies, and 50s television, I always thought in America, cream rises to the top. But over the past few decades, I now have to conclude that cream does no longer rise to the top. Shit does. If you want cream to rise, it has to be stirred, but not shit. Shit just floats to the top all by itself. And if cream is stirred, and rises to the top. Things never get creamier. They just get shittier. In America, that always turns to shit. And when it rises to the top and does that, as it has with the Clintons and the Bushes and the Cheneys and their ilk, things, folks, always do get shittier. But thanks to the remnants of a free press and an internet, great journalism, great writing, and great investigative reporting, all getting creamier, as is evidenced by my cohorts, Joe Satilli's outstanding newsletter, News Vandal, whom you'll meet in the second half of the show. But right now, though, the author of the best researched and easiest to read book I've ever read about the oligarchs' intelligence community's use of illegal drugs to destroy or discredit any citizen opposed to their plans or their plans of imperialism. It's called Drugs as Weapons Against Us. His first must-read book is The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur and Other Black Leaders. He was here months ago to talk about that mind and eye-opener, and it has taken us this long to get him back. From a family of activists, a graduate of Columbia University in counseling and psychology, he has for the past 25 years been an active drug counselor in Baltimore, where he lives and works. A very, very informative pleasure to have him back again, John Potez. John, welcome back to the show. It is a delight to have you here.
Thanks so much, John. That was a very nice introduction.
Ed, I must tell you, the book is such a great read. I mean, you could open the preface to the book. The preface is wonderfully written and worth the sale of the book itself. But the chapters that you outline, very simply, you could pick any name performer, any name politician, and go to that page and read the most interesting stuff. You have a lot of fans. And one of them sent me this wonderful quote from John Ehrlichman's book. And by way of a springboard for you to get into talking about your wonderful book, I'm going to quote this and acknowledge my fan and your fan for sending it in. So here it is. It's from John Ehrlichman's autobiography. Quote, the Nixon campaign in 1969 and in 68, and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. Understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or blacks, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities, we could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did, unquote, John Ehrlichman. So I have two questions to ask you about that. First of all, John, if Ehrlichman was aware of the fact that he was destroying lives by participating in this, why would he do such a thing?
Yeah, it was just part of the even much larger strategy of the use of drugs to counter and attack any opponents of the, you know, Nixon's political aims. And those political aims were continuing the Vietnam War, were squashing the civil rights movement, you know, stopping it where it's at, you know, particularly the, of course, Black Panthers and what they were trying to do, and stop any movement that was trying to change society for the better of the 99% of us. And so Ehrlichman just didn't care about the average person. He only cared about career advancement and supporting his president, who was helping his career advancement.
Well, he's the perfect description for what came out of the Nuremberg trials, the banality of evil. When you were a youngster, John, did you take drugs?
Yeah, I did have a drug problem myself in high school, and then in college I started to clean it up, but not before I guess, tripping about a half dozen times my freshman year of college. And before I started tripping, you know, college, you know, after drug problems with other drugs in high school, when I cleaned myself up a bit for a semester of, freshman year of college, things weren't so hard. You know, once I just stopped smoking so much weed and drinking and doing some other things, I could get decent grades at a tough school. And then when I ate about a half dozen hits of acid, took that acid, I just lost those abilities all of a sudden. It took me a year or two to gain them back, but there's some abilities I never got back. I lost my ability to write a full page of paper in my head without picking up a pen and, remember every word. But luckily I did get, enough back to, get good grades again and, and do the kind of research I had to do for this book. But it's sad to lose, one kind of skill that I never gained back. But my defense mechanisms were so strong that I had a hard time not doing what most people do, which is equate drugs with left-wing activism as positive. That's, because that's what we kind of were fed in the 60s. It's all about the hippies were all about changing society for the better, and they were part of the anti-war movement.
Do you think that was part of the reason that you took it, because you were an activist in stopping the war and those kinds of movements, and the government was targeting you people without you even knowing it? So were you influenced by that? Were you influenced by those fellow students? Were you influenced by pop stars, by musicians?
I was a bit, yeah. I was getting into left-wing activism. I was into those music stars that had done acid and done all the other drugs, and I was influenced them by a bit. And no, I don't think it was, I think it was purposeful by U.S. intelligence. They knew that these music icons would influence youth, especially activist youth for decades, for an eternity, possibly, you could say. I mean, but definitely for decades, obviously, with John Lennon and Jimi Hendrix.
Well,
so
if
they kept that picture of them in that way, yeah, people like me would still be influenced by them, yeah.
What was it that compelled you then? Because I got the impression from reading the book that you were going to write some kind of papers about your experience with drugs, but as you researched it, it expanded more and more and suddenly became this wonderful book.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, no, I just told that personal story that I just told just now in the preface, obviously. And then the rest of the book is about, based on counseling, thousands of people over 25 plus years of doing it, plus scientific papers, plus, CIA and FBI documents, plus just all different kinds of angles to show how they used all these different drugs through their MKUltra program. How the oligarchs kind of rose from the opium wars, gained incredible wealth and power, both in England and the United States.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but you mentioned the business of the opium wars, and that is how the British took over China.
Right. Yeah, and that's the first chapter. And so, they fought China, obviously, and that was the first drug war, in order to make China accept their opium, accept their heroin, and then, to exploit them. And I argue that they weren't just exploiting the Chinese, they also used the heroin and popularized the opium and the heroin in England and in the United States. And that was in conjunction, like just after the Industrial Revolution in England, which came like a decade or two before the United States Industrial Revolution. They used that against workers that were fighting against the horrible labor practices in England. And so I showed the conjunction of that and how that was used then. And then, the rest of the book, after the first chapter, takes place around 1947 onwards. And that gets into the CIA's MKUltra program and showed how the same oligarchs that made such incredible money off of opium, which includes the Russells were the biggest opium trafficking family, but you had the Cabots, the Lodges, the Pierponts, they were all intermarried. And the Pierponts, of course, is of Julius Pierpont Morgan fame, who now has the largest bank in the world. You know, J.P. Morgan Chase, according to Forbes magazine, is the largest bank in the world. And I show that's no coincidence, because these massive amounts of drugs that are trafficked and then sold in the streets, that money is then laundered through these major banks, most of the major banks, and they make incredible amounts of money off the laundering of the money, not just the sale of the drugs, but the laundering of the drug money. And so I show how that mechanism works. And
For you, John, mm-hmm. What was the biggest shock? I'm going to tell you a couple of the biggest shocks that I had. Sure. And then we're going to make this really easy for you and easy for anyone who buys the book. I'm going to mention a number of names that you have done considerable research on in the book, and it's just fabulous reading. But the one that shocked me the most was one of my dear friends who I call the Nicholas Tesla of music, and that was Frank Zappa. Mm-hmm. What is it that you discovered about Frank and his father?
Well, yeah. Now, this was based a little more on secondhand research than primary research, but this was based on Dave McGowan's great book, Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon. But Zappa, and, you know, it's interesting because I found out more after I put the book out, I found out more interesting stuff about Zappa. It didn't make him so negative, you know, because I liked Zappa before I did this research. But what I found out about Zappa's father worked for Edgewood Arsenal here in the Baltimore area. And that was a major manufacturer of chemical weapons for the CIA and U.S. intelligence and military intelligence. And that was major. They did major work on MKUltra. The CIA's MKUltra is really the umbrella program for all I talk about in my book. And MKUltra, their documents say, and I copy their documents in my book, where they say the use of drugs is unconventional warfare. And so they did some of their first experiments with these drugs on about 1,000 Edgewood Arsenal soldiers. I got the results from that they came out with, and it's about 24 different drugs, you know, most of the illegal street drugs that you can possibly think of, and some, of course, pharmaceutical drugs too. And you know, showed how they knew the effects, so they knew how they can use them as weapons. But they weren't just weapons in warfare abroad; they're weapons on warfare against protesters and dissidents and potential protesters and dissidents in the United States and England and other countries where people were, you know, opposing their agenda. So Zappa, his father was working in this field, and the son, Frank Zappa, gets just handed this massive promotion for music, for playing music, put on TV immediately, made an instant star. See, he goes out to Laurel Canyon, where dozens of top musicians flocked and then became instant stars out of nowhere, whether they were good or not. Now, Zappa, I think, was, you know, rather talented, even though I can't say I loved his music, but I respected his, you know, interesting, unique style. And so he ends up renting a house where they have huge drug parties, and they have loads of celebrities, and a particular guy named Vito Pelikas, who is actually the first cousin of one of the Rockefellers, actually a Rockefeller wife. And he's a very interesting guy himself, because he starts this hippie movement in the early 60s. And has all these dancers who took these dance classes with them that would go to all these concerts in L.A. where these new Laurel Canyon musicians all of a sudden, you know, turned up, and make the shows instantly popular by having all these young, beautiful dancers dancing at their shows. So they had an instant crowd, and then they got instant radio play, instant TV attention, and became instant stars. And we're talking about Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and a lot of different stars that we know. America, you know, had the song Horse with No Name, and, you know, many of the major stars that we know. And so Zappa had these sex and drug parties where these dancers would then come up nude and have, you know, orgies at these parties. And so it became a haven for getting so many musicians who were visiting from England, like the Beatles and other musicians who would visit, in, you know, taking drugs for the first time or the second time. and turning them on to all kinds of different drugs, particularly psychedelics, I argue. And so that's where they lured tons of musicians into the drug scene and got them, you know, doing drugs.
Yet, John, like John Lennon, a lot of the words that Frank spoke, especially when he was on live television with me, were anti-war and anti-government. So was he lashing back at something he knew was wrong, or was he lashing back at his father?
Well, I think he did lash back, and that was an interesting aspect of him. When he first played the puppet and did his father's bidding, he was, you know, he was doing some ugly stuff. And though he, you know, accounts of that, of those party scenes, said he actually wouldn't touch any drugs. He was just like the maestro of the party and the scene without touching any drugs himself. So he knew what was going on. But my first interview when I first came out with this book was with a guy named Alan Handelman, you might know, who has a radio show called Rock Talk. And he said that his first interview was with Frank Zappa when he first started his show. And Zappa told him that the CIA was giving acid to all the hippies. And
was Frank's manager also associated with the intelligence community?
Well, Dave McGowan says he was, and shows some links about his manager, and shows links to his producer and different other people that he was involved with that kind of helped him get big quickly. But I agree with you that I think Zappa turned on his father and turned on U.S. intelligence and started, you know, talking a different game. At first he was apolitical, but then he became more political and started to expose some of it. And some people think that when people like him expose this kind of stuff, they die younger than they're supposed to. Because one of MKUltra's goals and one of the things I saw research on is that they could produce cancer-causing agents that can give people cancer quickly and have them die young. That happened to him.
You point out, as in the case of Janis Joplin, she was about to give her first anti-war concert when she died.
Right, and it was like no other concert. These were stadium anti-war concerts that had not been done before. They were unprecedented, these huge stadium anti-war concerts she planned. And she was given a hot shot, I argue, right beforehand. You know, wow.
Now, let's go to a lady who is still alive, because you have extensive stuff about her, and there's extensive stuff about her. It's Courtney Love and Kurt Cobain. And all over the internet, you can find these very interesting stories about the questionable death of Kurt Cobain. Tell me what you discovered and what you believe about her and Kurt.
Yeah. Well, it's this is a more controversial part of my book, but Kurt Cobain, if anyone read his life and times and his quotes carefully, he was a serious radical leftist. His first girlfriend was Toby Vail of the radical feminist band Bikini Kill. She turned him on to radical leftist politics in a big way, and he did benefits for AIDS organizations. He did benefits for fairness, accuracy, and reporting. And would talk about the corporate media and how we got it. He says he would only appear on the cover of Rolling Stone if he was allowed to wear the shirt that says corporate magazines still suck. And so he was a serious activist and was very serious anti-materialist. And he was really influencing, you know, being the most popular guy in the world at the time of his death. He was influencing so many people to take on his views and his values. But I also argue the fact that when he started rising to the top, he was psychologically profiled, and here comes Courtney Love into his life immediately and gets knocked up quickly, and he does the right thing by marrying her when she gets knocked up immediately, but he has her sign a prenuptial agreement. And so then he was divorcing her, and a private investigator named Tom Grant actually has audio tapes of Kurt Cobain's lawyer saying, you know, he was asking to take her, Courtney Love, out of his will. He was asking her to find a divorce lawyer to get divorced as soon as possible. And so you can hear some of that in the movie Soaked in Bleach. But you can also hear experts like Cyril Wecht, you know, one of the top pathologists in the country. He's testified on, you know, he's been on CNN many times. He was just shown in the film Concussion. And so Cyril Wecht says that this, you know, the the finding of Kurt Cobain's body and the immediate same-day pronouncement that it was a suicide is completely unacceptable. You have to do all kinds of studies of the body, what was in the body. It takes weeks to get tests back on different aspects of the whole of his body and the scene to know what really happened. And he says that, you know, he just showed the basically that it was a cover-up.
And then you obviously show the evidence that suggests there was foul play.
Yeah.
What kind of evidence exists thereafter that shows that Courtney may have been involved in that foul play?
Yeah, just an incredible amount of evidence. But some of the evidence is a guy saying, passing a polygraph exam twice and then saying on film that Courtney Love gave, you know, offered him $50,000 to blow her husband's head off and make it look like a suicide. And you can see that in the film Kurt and Courtney. You know, that's available on YouTube to easily see. And then he died within days of making that comment on film for the award-winning film documentarian Nick Broomfield. So this is some of the evidence. There's a massive amount of evidence that Courtney Love had something to do with it. Now, obviously, she couldn't orchestrate all this herself and orchestrate the cover-up. She doesn't have that kind of power. That kind of power is only found in high, you know, very in U.S. intelligence. They can cover up things in the media. They can cover up things, you know, with the police, and, you know, do things, get police to say. For example, one of the police officers who came to the scene said the suicide note was obviously ridiculous because the handwriting changed at the only spot that could possibly be interpreted as a suicide note. And he said, you know, and so they all thought, you know, well, we got to investigate this as a possible murder. But their supervisor said this is to be investigated as nothing but a suicide. You know, anything else is just a pretense. And so he told the award-winning reporters, Wallace and Halpern, that. And they published that in their book. They had two good books on the subject. So then you also have the fact that – so I interviewed Courtney Love's biological father, and so he said, Hank Harrison said that basically he lost custody of Courtney when she was about 4 or 5 years old because her biological mother was an adopted daughter of some very wealthy people who basically paid off his lawyer so that he would lose custody of Courtney. And then that biological mother of Courtney Love, her name's Linda Carroll, she said that she basically had Courtney going to counseling at the age of 3 years old, which is absurd, you know, amongst counseling. No one counsels a three-year-old. But either way, so she has him going to counseling at three, taking psychotropic medications at about 3 or 4 years old. And then she basically gives up Courtney at some point, goes to New Zealand and gives her up to other people in the United States when she's somewhere between the ages of 8 and 10 years old. And so Courtney Love ends up in some institution and writes to her biological father because the mother had taken her away from the biological father completely and the father went into a deep depression. Courtney writes the father and Hank, you know, Hank Harrison, and says that, you know, please get me out of here. I've been, you know, my counselors for years have been having sex with me and giving me all kinds of drugs, including psychohypnotic drugs, and she names them. She's only 13 years old, and she's naming these psychohypnotic drugs, Tuenols and Secanols. Now, Tuenols and Secanols were MKUltra drugs, and I show the evidence, and I show other people testifying at federal hearings on MKUltra that they were abused sexually and given these psychohypnotic drugs, and they were similar ages as Courtney Love when this was happening, and they were turned into CIA operatives.
And all of this was undertaken by the Central Intelligence Agency and the oligarchs to stop Kurt Cobain from creating a larger anti-war movement. For you, John, and doing all this astonishing research.
Yeah, thanks. And I'll just say that then Courtney Love travels with CIA agents when she's about 16 or 17 years old, passing out drugs for free in different drug scenes around the world, in England and the United States.
Before, and does she admit that? Does she admit that?
Now, she didn't admit it, but Harrison named the CIA agent who he accidentally basically introduced to her. And that CIA agent on his deathbed in about 2004 or 5 wrote him a letter admitting that he worked for the CIA when he was, you know, traveling for weeks with Courtney Love.
For you personally, what was the biggest shock when you were looking into a number of these performers? I mean, I was shocked to find that you felt and seemed to have proven that even John Kennedy was injected with CIA drugs through his doctor, that Jimi Hendrix was murdered, and of course John Lennon. So expand on those for me.
Sure. Well, JFK, you know, there was a guy named Max Feelgood Jacobson, the White House doctor, and he was, evidence shows he was also working for MKUltra. He was at Andy Warhol's scene in New York, but he was also at Timothy Leary's mansion, where Leary, who admitted working for the CIA at some point, there was loads of MKUltra doctors just stationed at this mansion that was given to Leary for pennies by one of the oligarchs, which was Billy Mellon Hitchcock. And so him and his sister, Peggy Mellon Hitchcock, basically funded Leary's operation there and started the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which became the largest acid trafficking group in the world. And Ronald Stark became part of that group before he started LSD laboratories on various continents. And in the mid-1970s, Italian police arrested Ronald Stark and put him in jail. And the first judge to try to find out what he was all about was murdered. The second judge who, you know, tried to find out what he was all about had a government commission come in and investigate what was going on with this guy. And they found that he had been working for U.S. intelligence since 1960. And, and some very good books document that history. Martin Lee's book, Acid Dreams. Martin Lee was the founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting as a great journalist. And
how did Dr. Feelgood inject Kennedy, and what was he injecting him with?
Yeah, so it's not definitive. There's different accounts of what he was injecting him with. Some people say it was a mixture of cocaine and other drugs. Some people say it was speed. But he was injecting something that made him kind of somewhat hyper and ecstatic. So it was probably a combination of different drugs. So he was messing him up with those injections. I just cite some of the sources for what people have said were in those injections. They tried to get at him in different ways, but they couldn't stop him from trying to stop the nuclear arms race, from communicating with Khrushchev behind the military's back, and trying to create peace, trying to pull out of Vietnam. He put on paper, according to one of his advisors, Galbraith, and Galbraith's son's a professor at University of Texas, and you can see him on YouTube saying, the documents are all there, that he was saying, declaring that we were pulling out of Vietnam. We were not continuing that war.
I saw the very last interview he did with Walter Cronkite. I remember where they were both sitting, and I remember him saying that they were going to pull out 1,000 a month. They had 12,000 advisors in Vietnam. We would continue to supply arms, but they would have to fight their own war and win their own country back. So now we go to Jimi Hendrix. Just this phenomenal, gifted talent. And
yeah.
You tell me his story and about his death.
Yeah, it's very, because of racism in the United States, he could only get big in England. But the British musicians recognized his brilliance immediately. And so he became a superstar overnight. And he couldn't handle, all that fame and all that booking. So a guy named Mike Jeffrey inserts himself into Hendrix's life, and Mike Jeffrey admitted he was former MI6, and I argue that he continued to be MI6 undercover, and I show all the evidence of that, and MI6 is British CIA. So he gets into Jimi Hendrix's life and proceeds to sabotage his career after that first incredible album. He proceeds to sabotage Jimi Hendrix's attempts to do some work for the anti-war movement to do benefits. Jimi Hendrix was not very political before MLK's assassination. But after MLK's assassination, he did get very political, and he tried to do benefits for the Black Panthers and the anti-war movement, and it was sabotaged by Jeffrey. Jeffrey gave him a huge dose of acid before one anti-war benefit and hurt his guitar playing, and he ended the concert early. He put drugs on him at an airport and got him caught with drugs and arrested for drugs. And in Jimi Hendrix's fiancée's, Monica Daneman's memoir, she details all this. And so Hendrix was trying to get rid of Jeffrey, and he finally fires him, and within 48 hours of firing him, he dies. And so after his death, a guy named James Tappy writes at a party, and Mike Jeffrey's drunk, and Mike Jeffrey admits to him that he had Hendrix killed. And he pretends like it was for a different reason than on the behalf of British intelligence. But, you know, who can have someone killed within 48 hours of getting fired, you know? So it's just obvious that it was part of the plan of the oligarchs, you know, British and U.S. intelligence, to do away with Hendrix.
Well,
because
John,
of his anti-war work and because he was supporting the Black Panthers at that point.
John, I just want to remind the folks that the book is called Drugs as Weapons Against Us. And folks, you just heard just a smidgen of just some of the most incredible information about these great crime stories. It is really a very thrilling read because it's wonderful to learn something new. And you did say in the preface that the next book you were going to write would be fiction. It would be a novel. Well, I would like to try to talk you out of it. You're familiar with Mae Brussels.
Yeah, I think Mae Brussels is a great, incredible researcher, you know, really before her time.
One of the greatest. She was a granddaughter of I. Magnin, so she was very wealthy Beverly Hills housewife who all of a sudden saw Jack Ruby get murdered on live television and said, hold it, there's something wrong here. And it started, to me, the very best researcher ever about the black ops by this government. Have you ever seen the hour that she did on Charlie Manson and the murderer of Sharon Tate? Did you ever see that hour?
I think I saw a little bit of it, but I don't think I've heard the whole thing.
Okay, we do not have time to continue, but I am going to send you the link to this hour. Basically, she proves, I believe, that it was a black op operation by intelligence to stop the Flower Child movement. And you remember that the Flower Children were blossoming all over America, especially at Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco. And the moment those murders and the Tate-LaBianca murders occurred, the Flower Child movement stopped. And Mae Brussels' hour with the documentation, the kind of documentation and proof that you show in this great book exists. I am astonished that nobody has expanded that into a book. So I am going to send you that hour and that link. I want you to look at it, and I challenge you not to try to go ahead and write a book, because knowing you, John, you're going to want to do it. You're going to postpone your next book of fiction. So tell the folks where they can get Drugs as Weapons Against Us, where they can see some of your speeches, and where they can get your book about the FBI's war against the blacks.
Okay, so yeah, the full title of the book is Drugs as Weapons Against Us, the CIA's Murderous Targeting of SDS, Panthers, Hendrix, Lennon, Cobain, Tupac, and Other Activists. And you can find out a lot more about this book and the first book and the film based on the first book at drugsasweapons.com. That's www.drugsasweapons.com.
Well, I
Thanks
must...
so much, Sean.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you two things. I'm going to ask you, first of all, to look at that hour when I send it to you.
Sure.
You'll have my email address. Send me back your response to that.
Okay.
And I would love for you to come back in another month or so at my first available opening. Would you come back?
That'd be great. Thanks, John.
I just love to have you. You are so interesting. And if you also have a moment there in Baltimore after we say goodbye, I want you to stick around to listen to my cohort. His name is Joe Satilli. He is by far the best investigative journalist reporter in the country. He has a fabulous newsletter called News Vandal. So aside from sending you my Brussels Hour on the Tate murders and Charlie Manson, I'm going to send you a copy of this News Vandal, and we'll be talking to you again the end of May. And thank you again, John. And folks, we'll be right back with Joe Satilli.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knack, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World, every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on BBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World. Thank you all so very much. Thank you also for watching Beyond Borders, because I think they're going to pick up my son's show the first part of May. Thank you so much for ordering the DVD from Amazon, The Last Word on the Assassination, because shortly we're going to be starting on part two, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And I'm thrilled to announce that working with us on that will be somebody who's invaluable, and that's the man I'm going to talk to right now, Joe Satilli. Joe, welcome back, and how are you feeling?
I'm doing fine, and, you know, I do love, you know, some fathers and sons, they bond over fishing. Maybe they, go out and do nine holes, or maybe they go to a ball game. But a show business dad promos his son's show. It's wonderful.
Well, I'll tell you, I just am so, so proud of him. And the reason I'm so pleased is he had no help from his father. I mean, it's not like Michael Douglas being the father of Kirk Douglas.
Oh, right, right.
The son of Kirk Douglas. I mean, all my bridges had been burned or something.
Well, no, that is important to note, because he did not walk into a friendly situation. You did not, you were not, making a lot of friends as you exited your show business career.
And also his very first job in graduation from Stanford was as a researcher on the Garrison tapes. And within 3 months, he knew everything that his father knew. I mean, he's an absolute genius. Anyway.
Well, by the way, we also should note that he has a almost supernatural ability to presage events with his script writing, right?
Oh, it is remarkable. It happens with him all the time. So, that's something kind of metaphysical, and thank goodness he inherited his mother's disposition. My feet and brains, but her more perfect personality. Wasn't John Potash interesting?
Well, it's always interesting to me because I've long believed, and I cannot match John Potash for his, the breadth and depth of his knowledge. But it has always occurred to me that there is a nexus between war and drugs, and particularly between covert action and drugs. And this is something that I learned early on in studying the Vietnam War, because as a graduate student, my major field of study and as a historian was Asia and modern Asian history. And if you start looking into Vietnam, what you realize is that the way was paved by the CIA in the Golden Triangle. There's a little outfit called Air America. They were involved in heroin trade. I do not think it's coincidental that many of the young men, and particularly disproportionately young black men, because young black men disproportionately served in the Vietnam War. In other words, the percentage of soldiers who were black was higher than the percentage of blacks in the population. I think almost by 2-1. It was very close. I want to say it's about 27 to 28% of the soldiers versus about 13%. 14% of the population at that time. My numbers are hazy now, but and they came back with heroin addiction. And the 70s was an era in which urban centers were shattered by heroin addiction and by drug addiction. Much of that drug addiction brought back by soldiers from Vietnam who were using drugs that were provided by them through covert means in country and then also back in the United States to assuage all of the demons, the PTSD that they acquired fighting this war. And, it goes back, as you pointed out with him, to the Arrow and Opium Wars with the British and, of course, the great trading houses and bankers of the Eastern establishment in the United States. But it also comes – it's contemporaneous, because we talked about this a few weeks ago when the Panama Papers broke. And I made a linkage to something called BCCI. That's the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And it was a big scandal.
Huge.
Big scandal at the end of the 80s, the early 90s, that everybody has forgotten about. And I went and did some digging on that scandal, and I found a Time magazine story. This is Time magazine running this, and they interviewed, as Time reported earlier this month, the National Security Council used BCCI to funnel money to the Iran-Contra deals, and the CIA maintained accounts with BCCI for covert operations. And they go on to describe one individual who was an informant for the government who was involved in what he believes transferring heroin from Afghanistan in the 80s back through Czechoslovakia, which is interesting that Czechoslovakia was used as a way station, into the United States. So the CIA was involved in heroin dealing. And of course, the thing that really activated me in my life, in my sort of journalistic life, was Iran-Contra. And
yes,
what followed out of Iran-Contra, which was Gary Webb and the CIA's crack cocaine and cocaine dealing. And once you understand that this is kind of a playbook, it actually makes everything comprehensible. And I'm just going to tie this in. I know I'm a little long-winded here today, but I mentioned your son's.
You're never long-winded.
I mentioned your son's supernatural ability to presage events. Yeah. But if he was able to, if he had the intellectual capability to know as much about the Garrison tapes as you acquired over the course of many, many years in 3 months, that means he understands events. And the more you understand events, the more you realize that things are actually kind of understandable. Once you understand the playbooks, once you understand the processes, and this use of drug money for covert action is a playbook that has gone on forever, why? Because drug money is off the books. It can be tax-free. And that's why you have money laundering operations. That's why the mob used casinos. Because, you know, Vinny could go with all of that, his illicit gains, and he could go lose it to the house at the Sands and walk out supposedly losing all of his money. But all he did is took the money that was not legal and instantly made it legal by turning it over to the house by losing it at blackjack.
That's very, very true. How did the movie Kill the Messenger do, the Gary Webb story? Do you know?
Well, yeah, I think it had sort of a cult following, and it did okay. I've watched the movie about 5 times now, and I do know the Gary Webb story very, very well. I write for Consortium News, and Robert Perry knew Gary Webb and has championed Gary Webb's life and work over the years, because Bob Perry was one of the two men who broke the Iran-Contra story for the Associated Press after Eugene Hasenfuss's plane was shot down by Contras in 1985-86. And it was basically true to the story. I think the oddity is for these kinds of stories, and it's something that was maybe faced with the Kennedy assassination too, but maybe a little bit less because everybody experienced that viscerally. You know, where were you when Kennedy was shot? Nobody thinks, where were you when Eugene Hasenfuss was shot down? But there is something so nefarious about government agents profiteering off of the selling of illicit drugs and destabilizing whole populations of the United States for many, many reasons. I think it's one of those things that's really hard for people to get their heads around. Although I have to tell you, Joe, I don't think folks in the black community have a hard time getting their heads around it.
Do you know the very, very worst thing about what it is that these law enforcement officers are doing or supposed to be doing, these criminal activities that they're involved in? Like we quoted Holloman at the top of the show, but he knew that what they were doing with the drugs. The horrible thing is that law enforcers have no respect for the law, so it's totally meaningless to them.
Yeah.
So they must think this whole country is a bunch of bullshit, so I better get what I can when I can.
Well, this is what, you know, this is the sort of the funny thing I think about gangster rap, which everybody was really worried about in the 90s. Oh, look at these young black men with their pants low and they're talking about their bling and getting their money and I'm going to get mine. And it's like, well, but isn't that really the American way? And isn't that also why The Godfather was such a popular movie? Because ultimately, the Godfather films were actually more mythological than they were biographical about the Italian experience. It was about the American way of doing business, which is paying off, cutting corners, doing what you have to do to get the
problem. We've had some technical difficulties. I'm not a techie, so I am overwhelmed by all of this stuff. It's like being locked in that missile that Stanley Cooper created in 2001, and Hal is taking over his life. He took over my phone. He's taken over my computer. Anyway, sorry about that, Joe. Please.
No. I do the Ocelli effect every Tuesday night, and we often talk about covert action. We've come back to drugs many times because it's of interest to me, particularly what I consider to be the war on black males in America. When you think about 1 million black males being incarcerated as a result of the war on drugs, and you had that amazing quote from the Harper's story from Ehrlichman about the intention of the war on drugs on the part of the Nixon administration. So this is something that really I think is interesting to me. And, you know, right now Black Lives Matter is on everybody's mind, and I get the whole thing, all lives matter, but you really have to understand the extent to which black Americans have been targeted by the war on drugs, specifically targeted and disenfranchised, because it's like it's a bonus. So it's like a triple thing. One, you get to put black males in jail. So if you have any kind of racial inclination, there's that. Then you privatize the jail, so you make huge money off of that. You weaponize the police, so you make money as defense contractors weaponizing the police, and then you disenfranchise them so that they cannot come out of jail and vote against you
in the next election and keep you from continuing the policy.
And that is all deliberate.
Deliberate. I don't think there's, you know, when I was an undergraduate, I was skeptical of these things, but the evidence is just absolutely overwhelming. And, you know, Michelle Alexander wrote an amazing book called The New Jim Crow, and she details with all of the data that anybody might want exactly how this policy has been implemented.
What's the author's name again?
Michelle Alexander, and the book is called The New Jim Crow.
Do you think we should have Michelle on the show?
Oh, if you could get Michelle, I mean, she'll put you on your heels. It's staggering stuff. And, you know, I took an African American history course for a full year when I was an undergraduate, and I had a great professor named Toby Coles, who played me a speech by a guy named Manning Marable, who was a professor of history, I think at that time, the University of Colorado Boulder. And he laid this all out, and this would have been circa 1988. And this is why I said, you know, about CIA drug connections with crack cocaine. You know, I think in the black community, they just know that this is true. They experienced it. And if they know the story of Freeway Rick Ross, who was a guy who became the CIA's main conduit in Los Angeles for cocaine from the Meneses brothers and from basically the Contras, and the cocaine was getting funneled in, and they were cooking it up into rocks. And the thing about rocks is that it was, you know, for $5, $10, or $15, that's something somebody on the street could afford. Cocaine, powder cocaine, was still the pricey status symbol of upper class whites, and it was not accessible to lower class blacks, and crack cocaine sadly democratized the drug.
Joe, educated blacks and those who are employed and those who can still vote are perfectly aware of what the government has been doing to them. Why on earth are blacks supporting more in their numbers Hillary Clinton and not Bernie Sanders, who has proven with his body that he's been out there to help them?
I think a lot of it, and I don't want to absolve the entire black community of not being able to understand the full complexity of the Clinton years, but I think a lot of it, John, is actually the media. I mean, I've observed the media from day one of this election, and I've watched it closely. I've watched all of the coverage I could handle, and then some. A lot of the coverage I can't handle, as you pointed out in the beginning of the show. You know, you do need a little baby wipe after you watch. But I think that the media has hampered Bernie Sanders' message from the get-go.
Yes, they have tried to hamper it. But look, he had 48,000 to 50,000 people in New York City the other day, okay? Hillary can't get 4,000 into a room. Now, Donald Trump, I can sort of understand it because he's gotten hours and hours of free media because he gets ratings when he appears on these news shows. So they put him on, but they put him on because he's a performer or he's a buffoon. But he is also building up a following, but not even his following.
No, not even close.
Pumped by the media, doesn't come close to the following that Bernie Sanders has in money and, more importantly, in affection and in belief. So what is happening is I am developing a growing fear that they may begin to soon censor the internet, because what has happened is the younger people have bypassed CBS and CNN and ABC and NBC, bypassed it and gone to the internet and found Bernie Sanders and fallen in love with the man.
Yeah. I think it's also true of younger African Americans are more likely to support Bernie, and the African American support that has at least the high profile like Spike Lee has been skewed younger. I think what the Clintons have been able to do is play on a long standing loyalty that is built into Bill Clinton's political prowess at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s. Remember, John, the whole media bought into the narrative that Bill Clinton is the first black president. That was America's first black president. That was said in the media all throughout the 90s, and retrospectively when he was leaving office. And I think now people are starting to look back at Hillary Clinton's super predator comment. They're looking back at the crime bill. They're actually starting to look at policy as opposed to looking at relying on loyalties. And if you look at like her South Carolina election, a lot of that was built on what? Who could vote? It wasn't the disenfranchised young black men who had come out of prison who didn't have the right to vote. It was older African Americans, predominantly African American women, who had a long built-in loyalty to the Clintons that stretched back decades that they were able to pull on. I think the problem for Hillary Clinton going forward is whether or not she's going to be able to take the young support, whether black, white, or whatever persuasion that Bernie Sanders has been able to generate, and pull that into her election. Luckily for her, right now it looks like her opponent is either Ted Cruz or or Donald Trump, and she may not need it.
Well, your prediction then, I believe tomorrow is the primary in New York. Is it tomorrow?
Yep. Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Do you think Bernie is going to win?
I think it's going to be a squeaker, and I think she's going to squeak out a win. And I think a squeaker is not going to be good enough to tamp him down, and I think it's going to keep Bernie going. She needs a victory by 10 points.
Oh, she will never win by 10 points.
And I just there's so much upswelling, and you know, unfortunately for her, John, people don't like her. I mean, it's not just the policies. They just don't like her.
They don't like her at all. At all. There's no affection for Hillary, but there's affection for Bernie.
Yeah. Yep.
My feeling is it might be a squeaker for Bernie. And if it's a squeaker for Bernie, I predict before California, Hillary Clinton will implode. It will be spontaneous.
Spontaneous. You remember your there was a knockoff, a response to your great show, Real People. And of course, I am a child of television, as we've established many times on this show. I watched a lot of television, John. I mean, I watched a lot of television. And there was a show that was developed in response to your show. It was called That's Incredible.
I sued them.
Yeah. Okay. So one of their first, I think it was within the first two or three episodes of That's Incredible, with it was John Davidson, Fran Tarkenton, and Kathy Lee Crosby, right?
Gosh, that's right. Yes.
Okay. And within I think it was one of the first two or three episodes, they did a big segment on spontaneous human combustion. Do you remember that, where people would just, the idea was they would just burst into flames, and all that would be left is like a little globule on the floor. And they're like, well, there's Uncle Bill. We don't know what happened.
That's right.
They made their ratings off of spontaneous human combustion.
Yes, they did. Well, Hillary will lose hers. Anyway, Joe, thank you once again. Sorry for the technical glitch, and apologies to those folks. Okay, now, where can they see and hear you again? Where can they get your news, Vandal?
Tomorrow you can listen to me on American Freedom Radio, Chuck Ochelli. That's Ochelli. If you just put in Chuck Ochelli, good Paisan, it'll pop up. I'm there 6 o'clock tomorrow Pacific time for a full hour. And just go to newsvandal.com, NEWSVANDAL, newsvandal.com, and it'll pop up. You can sign up right there. Today, we didn't even get to it, John, but what a rip-roaring set of stories on Saudi Arabia 9/11. I think we are getting ever closer to having the dam break on that connection.
Well, I just made a note of that because I saw it, and I wanted to get to that with you, and unfortunately we didn't. But in 2 weeks, it will still be news. So hopefully we will start off with that again. Joe, thank you so much. I want to thank Doug Newsom for engineering the show. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for having this wonderful network, BBS Radio, in which we appear. And of course, I could not do the show without the help of my producer, Mike Kim. So Mike and Don and Doug and Joe, thank you so much. And thank you all for listening. And don't forget, Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock on CBS, Beyond Borders. Talk to you in a couple of weeks. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire.
sunny, 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 I love you.